Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
Welcome, listeners, to the story behind the song. I'm your host, Peter Chadi of Deep Cuts Media. Huey Lewis and the News represented the ultimate in music counterprogramming in the early to mid-1980s. Starting with their second album, the band rattled off an incredible 17 top 40 singles, 12 of which reached the top 10. But it was the band's third album, Sports, that blew things wide open. Released early 1983, Sports just recently celebrated its 40th anniversary. Just think about it. The Heart of Rock and Roll, I Want a New Drug, If This Is It, and Heart and Soul, all were top 10 bangers from the same album. In this episode, and just in time for the opening of the new Broadway show, The Heart of Rock and Roll, based on the band's great music, I talked to Huey about all of it. How he and the band did it, the writing, recording, and producing, but Lewis also spoke to me candidly about his significant hearing loss. Suffering from Meniere's disease, Lewis can't even recognize his own songs anymore, but he remains eternally grateful for the life, family, and good fortune he has had, and for all the exciting things ahead of him, including his new Broadway show. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind the songs from the great Huey Lewis and the News album, Sports. So usually in Story Behind the Song, we cover one song, but you have so many great songs on that album, and it's the 40th anniversary. So today we'll focus on the album and just how it came to be. But first, I wanted to just get a sense of your road to becoming a musician. From what I understand, you were hitchhiking across the country, you busked, and a lot of other things. Like, is it, I don't know if it's true, you stowed away on a plane to Europe, you got a perfect SAT score in math, and then went to Cornell, but then left Cornell. So just tell me a little bit about your journey and tell me if those things are right.
Well, yeah, you just did it. I was born in New York City. I was raised in Northern California. My dad was an amateur drummer and a piano player, and there's always music around. He had these jam sessions, and I always thought, looked at the bandstand and thought, man, that looks like the most fun thing ever. Yeah. So I got, when my parents split up, my mother rented a room to a folk musician called Billy Roberts, who wrote Hey Joe, and he played harmonica on one of those harmonica braces. He had a bunch of harmonicas and he gave them to me. So I started playing harmonica. And then I graduated from high school a year young because I was 16. I'd skipped second grade. And my dad, I was accepted to Cornell. I was going to go to engineering school at Cornell. And my dad said, he's the one who promoted the idea for me to go east to prep school. And now he said, you know, I think you're 16. Most of your decisions are all on your own. You can do whatever you want. You're in charge of your own life now, but for one thing. And I said, what's that? He says, I don't want you to go to college. Not yet. I said, but dad, blah, blah, blah. He said, no. I want you to take a year off and bum around Europe. And I went, oh no, but you're young, take a leave of absence. So I did. And I took the harmonicas because they, you know, and I played by the side of the road and I bussed throughout Europe. And I was, and then I went back to Cornell my freshman year, and I'd had almost all the stuff before in my prep school, so I didn't really have to go to class much. And I just played music and played in bands and blah, blah, blah. And it finally sort of, you know, obviously my year off playing music in the streets of Morocco was a lot more interesting than, you know, a physics class at the engineering quad. And so, you know, I dropped out after 2 years, went back to San Francisco, which had exploded by now with the music scene and all that, and joined bands. And that's how I started.
Yeah, pretty amazing. So your father, by the way, I think that's great advice to not immediately go into college, right, or take some time, right, off during college to explore the world. I think that's great advice.
It's what he thought, is that a lot of people just wind up 35 years old as an engineer and said, oh man, I really wish I was a musician. Music is my hobby. I wish I had made music my profession. So you never know. And it's a good, you get on that conveyor belt and it's good to get off it once in a while. And that was his theory and worked for me.
But you were so young, and your father was fine with you being this independent guy going to Europe at, I guess you were 16, you said, because you graduated a year early.
I graduated at 16. I turned 17 in July, and I went to Europe in August. So it was, I just turned 17.
Okay. I have to ask you about the stowaway incident, because when I was researching this and I heard that you had stowed away to Europe, I wasn't sure if that was real or not.
Right. Yeah. So I hitchhiked across the country. I took the year off and I was headed for Europe. And I'd heard that you could stow away on planes and all this stuff, all this hitchhiker stuff. So I took the harmonicas and a knapsack and I hitchhiked across America. I graduated from prep school and I took the year off, but my classmates, a couple of them had gone to Harvard. And so I stayed with them in Cambridge at Harvard. And I heard there that you could go to New York, to Kennedy, what was then Idlewild Airport, it's now Kennedy Airport, and go to the mail, general delivery or something, and go with a mail plane or something. There was some theory about that. But another guy I hitchhiked with explained to me how you can stow away on a plane. And the idea was, in those days, there were no computers, if you remember. And so when you bought a ticket at the airport, what they would do is put it in an envelope, and then you'd go with that envelope and that ticket to the gate. And at the gate, there'd be a little podium there and somebody there, and they would look at your envelope and open it, take the ticket, shut the envelope, and write EF. You write your seat number on outside with it, but in the destination, LHR, London, EF, and then with a special silver pen on your envelope. And then that basically would receipt in there. And that was your ticket. That was it. So this guy said, you go to an empty gate and they have those pens in the drawers and you get you do all this. And then you don't. And then you get in there early and then you go into the plane, write a fake seat number and all. So I thought, well, maybe it's possible. So I went to Kennedy Airport and I slept on the couch there. And I befriended one of these agents, and then it was TWA. Remember Transworld Airlines?
Oh yeah.
I went to TWA, one of the agents, and I said, look, I'm a student. I'm trying to get to Europe, and I don't have any money, and blah blah blah. And the guy told me there's a way to blah blah blah. He goes, I'll tell you what, you wait till I get off tonight at midnight, and I'll show you. And at midnight, he got off and he gave me the pen and he gave me the thing and he wrote on their LHR and he showed blah, blah, blah. He says, you get in there early. And then the only way they're going to find you out is just before they shut the doors to the plane, they count everybody. So what you do is you put the seat number you write on the is middle seat over the wing, which is the last seat to go. And then when you go on the airplane, you don't sit in that seat. You sit in another terrible seat. And if somebody else has that seat, you go, oh, I'm actually over there. And then you hope that nobody's on the middle of the wing. So, and in those days, the flights weren't all sold out. And he says, the only way you're going to get found out is if at the end of the deal, they count everybody. And then they count everybody who checked in at the podium. And they're going to be one more person on the plane than checked in at the podium. But they're going to think they just missed the count. They're not going to hold up the plane and try and figure that out. So you're going to be fine. And if you want, he says, if you want, you can not take the ticket, buy the ticket if you have the money, and then reimburse it when you get there. And then if you get found out, you can give them the ticket. So that's what I did. I spent my last $300 on an airplane ticket. And then I stowed away on there without it. I'd never showed him the ticket. And as soon as I got there, I said, after the flight's gone, won't they? No, he says, it's fine. You can get reimbursed right away. And sure enough, I got reimbursed.
It does take an SAT of 800 to be able to figure that all out, for sure. It takes a smart guy, a smart, savvy guy.
So you just need to be desperate. You need to be desperate. I mean, I arrived in London with $10 to my name and waiting for my refund for my $300 plane ticket.
E In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
You know, it's pretty amazing that, so the serendipity of the fact that your father said, hey, son, take a year off, go do this, and your whole life changed because of it, because you became a musician rather than going straight to school and becoming a, you know, you were in at Cornell, a grade school, and being an engineer or something like that. And also just the independence of a young guy. Can you imagine now one of us parents saying, okay, kids, go to Europe and you have $10 to your name? I can't even imagine.
I mean, the work, this was, you know, 55 years ago. So yeah, the world was a different place 55 years ago.
Yeah.
Our population was what it is now.
Yeah, for sure.
There were far less rats and a lot more cheese.
Yes, that's true. So
55 Huey, years ago.
And another thing, that you went through an evolution, because your name isn't Huey, your actual name is not Huey Lewis. And so I read a little bit about it, but when you were younger, before Huey Lewis in the news, you started using a name, a moniker like that, and then it went through different permutations. And just how did you come up with the name Huey Lewis?
Well, it was always my nickname. My first girlfriend's father used to call me Huey Louie, and that morphed into just Louie, which morphed into Lewis. Hey, where's Lewis?
Yeah.
So he called me Lewis. When I went to Britain and I played harmonica on some other records, I didn't have a green card. So, and they wanted to credit me, and I was afraid I'd get found out. And so everybody was changing their name anyway. It was the punk thing. So I called myself Huey Lewis instead of Hugh Craig.
Yeah. And it's interesting.
And they actually misspelled my name on Twiggy's record. And so I played on a Twiggy record and they spelled Lewis, L-O-U-I-S. And then that morphed into my first record with Clover, L-O-U-I-S. But it's it was all made up. So it didn't matter.
Yeah. Well, it worked, right? It's not all right for you. That's for sure. And then when you just mentioned the band Clover, which was the band you were in before you created Huey Lewis in the news. And again, as I was looking into things, it was interesting that Mutt Lange produced a couple of the albums of Clover.
Sure.
And of course, for all of you listening and watching, Mutt Lange is one of the great producers of the 1980s and beyond. But
he might be the most successful producer of the last 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, he's... You know, he did AC/DC and Foreigner and Def Leppard and Lady Gaga's stuff. And he's done, I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant producer and a really good friend, actually. And so, but we made the only record with Mutt Lange that didn't sell 8 million copies.
Yeah, but then, and that was that was with Clover. But then you started Huey Lewis in the news. Your debut album came out in 1980. But let's get into sports, because just limited time. And sports, like I said, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year with five top 20 songs, four of which were top 10 songs. And your debut album wasn't overly successful. Then your second album was very successful, but sports knocked it out of the park. So Huey, just what was your state of mind going into the studio for album number 3? And just tell us the approach, because one of the things you've said about that album is it's a collection of singles where you needed a single and you ended up getting five of them. So take us through a little of just how it all happened and what your state of mind was.
Well, you have to remember, 1980, now Sports was recorded in 82. We made Sports in late 81, 82. It was released in January of 83, but we recorded it in 81 and 82.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces like that. You have to remember, in those days, there was no internet. There was no jam bands. There was only one avenue to success, and that there was no YouTube. There was only one avenue to success, and that was a hit record. Radio ruled the roost. And it was it's called CHR radio, which is contemporary hit radio, which is FM's version of top 40. And but in fact, there were only 23 records, maybe. If you're number one, you'd get 9 plays a day. If you were number 23, you got like 1 or 2. So, and we all competed for that radio format. That is Huey Lewis in the News, Garth Brooks, the Commodores, Bobby Brown, Whitney Houston. I mean, everybody was competing for that thing. So you had to have a hit record. That meant you needed to make a lot of commercial decisions. And we wanted to make those ourselves. So we fought to produce ourselves because I had, after all, been in a band that was produced by Mutt Lange. And so I knew I knew my way around the studio because I'd worked with Mutt for a couple of records. And so I was convinced that I could, me and us, the band, could produce our record better than anybody else. And finally, our manager fought for us. And because our record label, Chris, was a small private label, Chrysalis Records, in London, 7,000 miles away, they couldn't really control us. They allowed us to produce the record ourselves. And so what I knew, we needed a hit record. So I aimed every song at radio because we knew we needed a hit. We didn't know we were going to have 5 of them. And so interestingly, the genres are different. You know, one's kind of a hard rocker, one's kind of a bluesy thing, one's a nice ballad, because we didn't know which one would be a hit, but we knew we needed a hit. And that's really the thing I'm proudest of, is that we did that all ourselves in San Francisco. Nobody produced their own records in 1982, and we managed to do it and get you know, some big hits, which was really the hardest thing for us. We've always been it. We always were a good band. We're really more like a jam band in our day, but there was no avenue for that. You had to have a hit record. So and when I listen to sports now, that's what it sounds like to me. I remember crafting each one of those songs for radio.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's incredible. That album went 7 times platinum, which is, for a lot of people out there, they may not even know what that means anymore, but that's over 7 million records that are sold. And the songs that were top 10 from that album, I Want a New Drug, The Heart of Rock and Roll, If This Is It, Heart and Soul. And like you said, that's kind of a nice mix. They're different. They have different styles to them. So,
and you know, interestingly, that's rare. That's because we produced them ourselves. A legit producer would never have so many disparate genres on the one record.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. It's kind of crazy what we did. I mean, it's got honky tonk blues and bad is bad. It's kind of nuts. But all of those ideas spoke to me and us, you know, and they're genuine because songs are gifts. Songs just come to you. So we gift these ideas and you write the song. If there's anything that I think that I'm rather proud of, it, the production on that record is kind of interesting, because with sports, when we first started recording it, we were in the record, we recorded in a bunch of studios in San Francisco, but we did a lot of stuff in the record plant. And then while we're recording in Studio B, in Studio A was Jefferson Starship with Ron Nevison producing, and the techno, Peter Wolf, the Austrian producer, was doing all the keyboards and the programming. And out of their studio, you know, I go out to the bathroom out of our studio, and out of their studio, I hear, "We built this city." And I went, "Whoa, what is that?" You know? So then I got Peter Wolf out and I said, "Peter, would you do me a favor?" Because this was 1981, 82. The Lindrum had just been invented. And the Lindrum was a drum. The first drum machine was probably 78, 79. And we knew all about it. We'd heard that this guy, Roger Lynn, had Jeff Beccaro's drums in a box. I said, "What? Yeah, drums in a box. Jeff Beccaro's drums in a box. It's a chip. It's a chip. What's a chip? I don't know." So we got one of these things. And my idea was to combine the Lindrum, the techno, up-to-the-minute technology of the Lindrum and the old-school songs that we were writing, the old and the new at once, if you will, as epitomized with Bad Is Bad, which starts with just Lindrums there. Dush, 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 dush. then come the vocal, the doo-wop vocal. So the idea being the old and new at once. And that's kind of what we did with, and, you know, Want a New Drug. That's a drum machine. And that's a sequenced bass. And then we dressed it up with fills and all that stuff. But that record, which looks from the cover to be just a bar band just jamming, is anything but. We put it all together piece by piece.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it wasn't obvious to, I think, a lot of us. I guess we just loved the song, so we didn't really think about it. But was there consensus with everybody in the band that, yeah, let's do this. Let's take this new technology and add it and kind of change our sound a little bit?
Well, you're asking all the right questions if you want to get the good stories.
Yes.
So now, Peter Wolf, I said, Peter, can you hook up that Lindrum for Want a New Drug? He says, sure. So he comes in and hooks up the Lindrum for Want a New Drug. And now we have sequenced. Is sequenced with. Okay. So I go, cool. All right. So I put it on drum beat. I'm making this up. 105 beats per minute, let's say. And now my bass player, Mario Cipollina, and my drummer, Bill Gibson, are in the control room now with me and the engineer. And the only person in the studio is Chris Hayes, our guitar player, and Sean Hopper, our keyboard player. And they're playing to the machine and the bass. Well, it just lies there. And it's not good. And it's just not happening. And they're miserable. My bass player and my drummer, back in here, I'm just miserable. So I go, oh, well, hell with it. It's not going to work. So I say, let's forget it. Let's just cut it. Forget the machines. Let's just cut it straight. So we cut the whole song, just, you know, played it. And then we finished the record. We went to New York. We mixed the record with Bob Clearmountain. And I mixed Want a New Drug like 3 or 4 times. I couldn't get it to groove somehow. It just wouldn't groove it like it should. But finally, I think I got a pretty good mix. We got a pretty good mix. And we were done with the record. But just before we could hand in the record, Chrysalis sold out to CBS. So now we didn't have a record label. And we weren't going to give the record to CBS because we were worried they haven't figured, the dust hadn't settled yet. And how were they going to promote it? And whatever. So the idea was, hang on to the record. Don't turn it in yet. And just hit the road and travel to make a living, because we had to pay the bills. So we hit the road. We called it the Working for a Living Tour. We did 10 weeks on the road with one bus. And of course, the first month on the road, we didn't listen to the record. We just finished this record, just mixed it. And we've been working on it for a year, you know. So we didn't listen to it. Last thing we wanted to do is listen to it again. We've been listening to it every single day and working on it. So we just let it ride and worked and did our show for like a month. And now one night after the gig, about a month into our tour, we get in the bus and we're going to drive overnight. And it's about, you know, it's after the gig. It's 11, 12 o'clock. We're in the lounge. I said, guys, let's listen to the record. Oh, okay, sure. So we put the record on and played it. And I went, it just wasn't happening. It was just not good. And Want a New Drug was not grooving, none of these songs. So I screamed foul and convinced the record label and my manager and everybody else that we needed to go back in the studio and re-record. We went back in the studio. We put the machines back on Want a New Drug. And instead of 105, we set it at 107. I'm making those up. I can't remember the exact numbers. Yeah. But we sped it up 2 ticks. And oh my God, it just came alive. And so we re-recorded Want a New Drug, Harder Rock and Roll, Walking on a Thin Line, Bad is Bad, all cut to the drum, to the Lindrum machine.
And did, when you heard that, like you said, it was kind of magic to you. Did everybody else in the band also feel the same way that, yeah, that's it?
So we are a really very much a band. You know, it's really is very much a band. I mean, I'm the singer, but that's pretty much it. And our drummer, Bill Gibson, who was most affected by this, because he's the one that wasn't going to play on every single song, got it completely, because he's a musician. He's a really good musician, a good singer, and a good writer, and he gets it. He's part of the band. He's one of the, well, and he got, and it's not that he can't play as good as a machine. It's the sound of that Lindrum, the dish, dish, that techno sound that you can't capture if you mic a snare drum, because there's too much ambience. So we wanted, you want that feel, that that techno edge that just against the old kind of R&B-ish kind of flow. So kind of the old and the new at once. And that was kind of our production style. And that's what we went for. And Bill totally understood that. You know, he understood that's what we were going for. And by the way, on subsequent records, we did completely the opposite. We've made records where we have no machines whatsoever. We just capture the performance and play it live. And we did a tribute record, Soulsville, where three of the songs are just completely captured with no overdubs. So we've made, there's no right way, right or wrong way to make records, but we were making sports for the radio, for CHR radio, that's going to play it nine times a day. And yeah, when you're going to get something nine times a day, it better be pretty perfect, because the flaws will suddenly get larger if it's not perfect. So, you know, what are you making the record for? And so that's why we poured over that so much, you know.
And when you were done with the process and you had changed the songs that way, you re-recorded them in that way. So you're done. It's in the can. Did you know at that time that this album was really special?
No idea. Zero. I knew Heart and Soul. You know, my theory as a producer was we're going to write the best eight songs we can and then the best two we can find. And that was kind of always been my philosophy. So we found this tune, Heart and Soul, got sent to me, and it sounded like a hit to me. And we just kind of copied that. So when that one went, that was our first single. And it went top 10. It didn't go top five, but it went top 10. And we were off to and then the second single was Want a New Drug. And that one, when Want a New Drug started to climb the charts, I said, wow, we're going to have a few here, because Want a New Drug is not a classic hit single. You know what I mean? It's more of a personality job. And so the notion that they like this personality, well, we got, if you like that, we got a lot more for you.
Yeah. It was I remember that time. I remember all these songs so vividly, like that, you know, those were, my salad days. And Huey, we're going to take a quick break right now. Be right back with Huey Lewis of Huey Lewis and the News.
You know, I'm going to divulge something here. We can't announce yet, but we're going to announce a Broadway show on Broadway called Heart of Rock and Roll that we've been working on for a long time, and it's going to come to Broadway, and all of these songs are a part of the show, of course. All the music is Huey Lewis and the News music.
Yeah.
And so, but what's interesting is how our musical director Brian Usifer, who's brilliant, I think, has given each of these songs a completely different setting than we did. And it's fascinating to hear them in another, you know, live a different life, as it were. And it's really gratifying to watch the song become something else. You know, it's really pretty cool.
No, I bet. And I read about that, and it is actually playing here in San Diego, where I live, at the Old Globe Theater.
It did. We put it up. It's down now. We did 6 weeks there. This was 3 years ago now, really.
Oh, wow.
Six weeks, and had a wonderful run. Sold it out every night. And now we've been waiting in COVID. Yeah. So we've been trying to get the show to Broadway, but now we're going to get it to Broadway.
Congratulations. That's outstanding. That's very cool. That's very, very cool. Do you remember, we talked about the production of the album, but and you talked about, you know, you wanted to, your goal was to get hit songs, to get some play. Do you remember what your process was at the time for writing these songs?
The writing of the songs is like a gift. You know, you get an idea and then you write it and stuff. So there's no way to, I don't think there's any way to just force, you know, to go to work and write a song. I mean, here's the thing. Yeah, and they do that in Nashville all the time. I mean, you know, they get three or four people together, or they get two or three people and they write a progression, and somebody else comes in and does the words and they want, you know, the lyric, and they do it. And, you know, they do that production thing and write those songs. But those songs, end up sounding like everybody. They're you know, and so, and then when you get somebody like, you know, you can love him or hate him, like Toby Keith, you know, who comes out with some song like some, you know, jingoistic thing. But the advantage is, you know, it wasn't written by a songwriting team. You know, I mean, it's written this was, or you know, or a Red Solo Cup. You know, this you don't write that. Yeah. For everybody, you know what I'm saying? So, and I think that's the thing with our songs. They sound like, some of them are funny a little bit and some of them are, but they reflect the personality of our band. And that's it. It's got, you know, it's, they say it's a singer, not the song. And it all great songs. You know, what's great about blues singers and R&B singers, the thing that's great is the commitment. The notion that whatever this guy is singing about, he's not kidding. He knows about whatever he's singing. And when you write your own songs, if you're true to yourself, that's a big plus.
Yeah. Yeah. So based on what you just said, it sounds like there was, you didn't sit down. It was kind of like you would be, I don't know, drinking your coffee in the morning. Something would come to you. You'd wake up and something would come to you or something in your head. And so for the songs that you wrote, did you typically start with the music or with the lyrics?
Each one's different. They're all different. But like, If This Is It was Johnny Cola's music and his progression, totally. And it was my job to write the lyric. And so, and it was real hard because it's a complicated song and it's got feelings. But, you know, when I write a lyric, I try to imagine what the music is telling me. The music is telling you what it wants you to say. And you have to be true to that. The lyric has to match the music. So that's the way we wrote that song. Bad Is Bad is a song I'd written with Clover. And Johnny thought of the doo-wop arrangement of that song. So Want a New Drug is an idea I had forever. I woke up one morning hungover and drove to my lawyer's. I had a meeting with my lawyer and it was late, or actually my publisher, Bob Gordon, and I was late. As a, you know, kind of, and then I had this idea, and I remember I parked it, I pulled in, I knocked on his door and he answered. I said, "Bob, do you have a pencil and paper you could give me?" "Yeah." "Before you say anything?" "Yep." And I pretty much wrote the whole song down. And then we tried to write, then I wrote a piece of music that didn't work. And then we did one but finally we looked for some music. We tried different things. Didn't really work for the lyric. And then Chris Hayes called me on the phone and he says, "I got it." Well, I said, "What?" I got a riff. I got the song. Want a New Drug? I said, "You're kidding." "No, I'm telling you." I said, "Well, come on over." And so he came over to my house. I hooked up his guitar into a little pig nose amp and we had my little Sony, you know, Walkman thing. And then we put record and he played the wick and I sang the song. We had the song.
So it was kind of like bam, bam. When it happened. Yeah,
our stuff is very collaborative, though. Extremely collaborative. Like in most cases, one or two of us will write this, the bit, but then we always get involved. And I think that's what makes them stronger. And when possible, we try to write it up and get a rough draft together and then play it. And perform it until, oh, now. And then you learn more about your song and then go back and retool. And that's a really great formula for distilling ideas, you know?
Yeah. Well, especially when you're, like you said, you're a jam band in many different ways, kind of like you described it as a bar band. And what's funny is the sports album cover, you're in a bar, right? And so yeah. You kind of brought it all together in that. Yeah. I guess a sports bar. Is that why?
That's it. And that's how most people witness their sports. That's how how they experience sports. Yeah. That's how they enjoy their sports.
Yeah.
Something in a bar.
So of all the songs on the Great Sports album, which is your favorite?
Which is my favorite?
Yeah. Which is your favorite on the sports album? Which song is your favorite?
I don't have a favorite. I mean, you're not allowed, you know, when you produce the records, you're not allowed to pick favorites because sometimes you have to work with the problem child, you know?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, some songs just come right out and others are harder to work on. And, you know, usually the ones that come quickly are the easiest, but even that's, there's just no formula for it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just graft. You just work at it. So.
Well, yeah. And you captured the inspiration in such a massive way to have one of the, you know, biggest selling albums of the time. So I know there's an 40th anniversary vinyl record that's coming out, and it's coming out in two colors, black and olive green. And I was just curious, why green?
No idea.
Oh,
it's a rare company's idea. I got no idea, but I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I don't have any other green vinyl record.
Yeah.
It'll be my green vinyl.
It's pretty amazing too, how vinyl is coming back. Well, it has been for several years now. And there's something that's, I think, really tangible about vinyl and the album covers and, you know, rediscovering the art of it. And it's not just for, you know, guys like me who've been around the block for a long time. My daughter is now almost 24, but she, for many, many years, and she still has her bedroom here at home lined with vinyl. You know, that's like vinyl is, there's something special about it. And that, like I said, that's coming out soon. You have the new musical that... You heard it here first, guys, that it's going to Broadway in the springtime, right?
Yeah. We're trying to, I mean, I can honestly say we're going to have a show on Broadway the next spring. That's for sure.
So how
that's
do you
all,
feel?
We're trying to cast and do all that and figure all that stuff out.
So how do you feel about that, Huey? Like, could you have imagined 40 years ago that you would have a Broadway show based on your music?
No, and this might be the best thing that's ever happened to Huey Lewis in the news, to be honest. I mean, the notion that we have a Broadway show is just fantastic. And we've been working on it for 10 years, you know? And so it's just so wonderful as a songwriter to hear the songs live these other lives, you know, it's pretty cool.
And are there any other 40th anniversary events that you're doing?
Not that I know of, but that could change every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, by the way, this record, these are Atmos mixes, I believe, which is new mixes where you suddenly are in the middle of the band. It's an interesting concept, one that I don't understand because I can't hear. I haven't heard music in 7 years. You could literally play me one of my songs and I couldn't identify it. Music is the first thing that goes with sudden hearing loss. It's a horrible thing. But apparently these Atmos mixes are really good. And it sounds like you're in the middle of the band.
Well, I want to ask you about your hearing loss because I was watching an interview recently. So you're very open about that and candid with what has happened with your hearing, which is, you know, for a musician such as yourself to have that happen where, as you described, you're not able to identify your own songs when you're hearing them. So how do you deal with that, Huey? And I'm not going to say it's more difficult as a musician, but it's just because hearing loss is just a terrible thing. But how have you learned to deal with that?
Well, as best I can is the answer. When it first happened, it was devastating. I spent, you know, I tried any matter of protocols, went to the House Ear Institute, Stanford, UCSF, Harvard Medical School, Mayo Clinic. Nobody has anything. I was depressed. Boom, pretty much. You know, worried, protocol, no salt, all organic, chiropractic, acupuncture, cranial massage, nothing worked. I was despondent, but I have two great kids who wouldn't let me go, really, you know? And so at a certain point, you got to move on. And, you know, and I have to remember there are lots of people worse off than me. I mean, you know, there's blind people, maybe blind is worse. I don't know. But bottom line is I try to stay creative, and that's what the musical is all about. And I have a little TV show I'm trying to develop, and, you know, I try and stay busy and creative, you know, just remind myself that there are others worse off. It's all I can do.
Huey, did your hearing loss happen gradually over time?
I lost my right ear 40 years ago, almost 40. No, probably 40 years ago. And then the ENT, and I had a very real bad vertigo bout, nauseous vertigo. And he went to an ENT guy who said, get used to it. We don't know what you guys said. You're kidding me. I'm a musician. I only got one ear. He says, you only need one. I said, well, I'm a musician. He said, look, Jimi Hendrix had one ear. Brian Wilson had one ear. He says, I have one ear and I'm in a barbershop quartet. I said, really? Okay. So I lived on one ear for a long time. And it's funny because you wear headphones and most of my hearing was in my left side, but your brain puts it right in the middle. So I could hear everything in the middle and it didn't really affect me. I was fine. I lived for another 30 years. And then 7 years ago, I lost my left ear. And that was tragic. And I, at a gig, I couldn't hear anything. And, you know, here I am. And I haven't improved, to be honest. I have Starkey hearing aids. I should give props to Starkey Hearing Institute because they fit me with these hearing aids that are spectacular. They Bluetooth to my phone, to my television, if I want, to my computer, so I can hear, you know, and function. The only thing I can't hear is music.
Well, that's inspirational itself in terms of how you deal with it, but also just that you candidly discuss it and openly discuss it, because everybody has something, you know, everybody like there. And it's great for people to be able to be open about it and give that kind of strength to other people. Is there something on your bucket list that you feel you still need to do?
I have this comedy, this TV show that I want to do. And we kind of sold it to Fox now. It's just in development now. You know, the musical is going to be just an amazing thing. So I'm super excited about that. I mean, I never thought we'd have a music. And then we started working on it and it's been, you know, really just a labor of love. And now it's coming to fruition. So that's great. But the other thing is this television comedy that I have. But, you know, the Zen Buddhists say you need something to hope for. You need something to love and something to do. And I have plenty to love. I have kids and two grandkids that are great. And I've couple great things to hope for. And that's where this is. And so to do, I stay busy creatively, you know, and then it's okay. Life is good.
That was Huey Lewis sharing his story behind the songs from the band's 7-time platinum album Sports, which just recently celebrated its 40th anniversary, in which songs are featured in the new Broadway show, The Heart of Rock and Roll. I'm your host, Peter Chatti. Reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com with your feedback and ideas of what artists you would like me to interview next. And for more of the story behind the song, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in each week to hear more. And make sure you're following the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. And as always, thanks for listening to the story behind the song.